Hello, and welcome to episode 101 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Chip Reed, CBS News national correspondent and former chief White House correspondent. Chip, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I like that 101. It reminds me, of course, that you're in my alma mater, Vassar College.
All right. Well, how about you give us the 101 on news today? The first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, at this very moment, I'm sitting watching Ben Carson testify on TV, and he's up in the Senate. I'm in our office on M Street. And if this becomes a story, it will be mine on the CBS Evening News tonight. And I have always considered pretty much everything I've done in my career to be a public service of some sort. When I was in law school and college, I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer and a human rights lawyer, something along those lines. I went to law school and I spent a summer in South Africa fighting apartheid, and I spent a summer at the International Institute of Human Rights. And then when I got out of law school, I went to work for Joe Biden for the better part of 6 years, handling all of his civil rights and constitutional law matters. And then I briefly went to a law firm. I absolutely hated it. I was working for mainly Wall Street investment banks, and I just the focus on money was something I just had no interest in. So I left there and got into the news business at a fraction of what I had been making at the law firm, and I love it. I just love the. My mantra is that my job is to help educate the public so they can intelligently participate in the democratic process. Now that's getting harder and harder to do because there are so many other outlets out there of people who act like journalists but really aren't, because they have an axe to grind or they have a point of view. I see myself as straight down the middle. My father was a teacher, and I have teaching in my blood. My father had a class of 30 students, and he had an hour to teach a lesson. I have a class of 6 million students, and I have 2 minutes to teach a lesson.
And when did it occur to you that it would be your calling to really teach those 6 million students of yours?
Very late in life. I didn't get into the news business until I was 33 years old. And it actually came, I was general counsel to Joe Biden's presidential campaign in 88. Actually, it was 87. He didn't make it to 88, and it went down pretty suddenly. And I just couldn't face being a real lawyer. I certainly didn't want to work at a law firm, as I said earlier. So I thought that, I see the news business as performing a public service of educating the public, and that's what I do, and I love it. I absolutely love it. And I've got the best beat in the world now. I've covered just about every beat in Washington. Well, not just about. I've covered every beat in Washington, and now I cover no beat in particular. I fill in for all the other beats, but my main beat now is doing feature stories about ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
So, feature story about ordinary people doing extraordinary things sounds a little bit like what we're attempting to do in this podcast. So I'd like to segue on that point to darts, the topic of darts. You once have been known to say that when you were working with the Biden camp, you felt as though you were at the receiving end of a bunch of darts being thrown at you by the press. You now are a member of the press, and you seem to have been taking great delight throughout the course of your career in being the source of those darts. Can you talk about the changing of the tables there?
Yeah, well, when I was not a press guy for Biden. I was a lawyer, so I wasn't on the direct line of taking the darts. But I mean, the press, the White House press corps, the campaign press corps, they got tough. I've been part of it, and they throw darts. And if you're in politics, if you're working for a candidate in a presidential campaign, you are catching the darts, and usually not catching them, just getting stuck by them. I've said that just the other day when somebody said, why did you leave presidential campaign politics and get into this business? And it's kind of joking that I say it, but there's also some truth to it, that I was tired of catching the darts and I decided I wanted to throw them. And, obviously Donald Trump feels like he's having darts thrown at him, and he responds in a very different way from any candidate I've ever seen before, with the possible exception of Newt Gingrich, who used to really go after the press. But, you know, I mean, truthfully, I don't see myself as throwing darts. I see myself as asking tough questions. When I was the chief White House correspondent, we had a briefing every day with Robert Gibbs and then Jay Carney. Yeah, I sometimes drove them crazy with my repetitive questions, but as I would tell them, when they'd say you're asking the same question over and over, I'd say that's because you're not answering it. So you have to be aggressive.
So on a topic of hard to ask questions and these darts, so, you know, you must assume, or one must hopefully presume, that the individuals in elected office, and let's just use the recent example you just brought up, which is individuals who happen to be president of the United States or candidates for president of the United States. You mentioned Gingrich and Trump. They, in their own minds at least, and in their supporters' minds, are doing the best they can to advance whatever they perceive is America's best interest. Now, as a reporter, you also said that you're trying to help educate the public of 6 million people, of the 330 million or so Americans, to improve the democratic process. In your mind, you've already said in this interview that you see yourself as helping to advance the public interest, yet you've also alluded to an antipathy that is somewhat natural between the Fourth Estate, the press, and the executive branch of the federal government. Can you speak for a moment? Why can you hypothesize on why there might be that antipathy, why certain candidates may seek to suppress the press if everyone is trying to advance the public interest?
Right.
You
think
they're all going for the same goal, but yet they really are trying to prevent the one from attaining the goal.
Right. Well, it's kind of a sloppy system we have under our Constitution and the First Amendment. It's not meant to be totally efficient. If it were meant to be totally efficient, there would be no free press, and whoever is in power would simply do what they want to do. So and I've always said that when I was a lawyer and when I was in politics, my job was always to take the truth and bend it a little bit, put a gloss on it, make it suit my client, meaning either the presidential candidate or Senate candidate I was working for or the paying law firm client that I was working for. Take the truth and bend it to suit their interests. My job now is to do my best to simply get the truth. And I know truth is a big word, but I want to be accurate. I want to be honest. I want to be fair. And I want to simply tell the public, here's what this politician says he wants to do and says he is doing. However, I talked to such and such source and this source and the other source, and the fact is they're doing this. It's a little different than what they're saying because they're trying to make it look as good as possible. And I'm getting behind the scenes and talking to people about what's really happening to tell you that the politician on this side is saying he wants to do this, and the politician on this side is saying he wants to do this. And I'm saying, wait a minute. Let's look behind the scenes and see what each of them is really trying to do, and I'm going to give it to you as honestly as I can because I don't have any incentive to say, to bend the truth. I just want people to know what's really going on. And so I feel that they're doing a public service by pushing their point of view, and I'm doing a public service by trying to explain to people that they're not being 100% honest with you. They are bending the truth because that is the nature of politics and that's the nature of being a lawyer.
So I want to ask you about an inherent partnership that you seem to, I guess, that one could infer from your statements that journalists have with the public. I want to ask how being in the press, you said a president wants to do what he wants to do and the press kind of holds him to task and reports on the truth. So I was wondering how being in the press or how the press actually could prevent the president from doing what he wants to do. And I guess in that question, there's what I mentioned earlier, which is an inherent partnership between the press and the public, meaning if it's just one person saying, oh, there's a discrepancy between what you said and it's not actually factual, doesn't there need to be action on the other side? Isn't there an implied partnership that someone's receiving and then acting upon the information you're giving them?
Yeah, but it's really up to them. The way I see it is my job is to tell the public what is our viewers, what is really going on. And I'm not saying all politicians are liars, but they do bend the truth. They will put the best face on what policy they are pushing. And we will go back and we will say, well, actually, you know, this isn't accurate. And then we have these fact checkers today who I think are that do a fantastic job of very concisely doing what we do, but it is, you know, it is a partnership, But the partnership is, my job is to tell the public, our viewers and listeners on radio and our readers on the internet, what is going on to the best of my ability, what is really going on. And then it's their job to decide whether to do anything about that. When I was in the White House, I did turn a number of pretty hard-hitting reports on the Obama administration when things weren't going well, during the Gulf oil spill, during the passage of health care reform, and doing my best to explain to people what was really going on. But then as to whether the public will actually respond to that, that's up to them. I put it out there, and you know, it's that all that Fox News saying, which I sometimes question, that we report, you decide. That's what I believe. We report, and people who are listening decide whether it's worth taking action.
So I'd like to pivot a moment to the story of Chip Reed. You mentioned that you were once a truth bender as a member of a politician's staff. And
right.
You now perceive yourself to be a truth teller to an extent. My question is about your career path, particularly when you were 33 years old and you transitioned into the news. Were you not greeted with a degree of skepticism? Clearly, you had been associated with liberal progressive politicians. Did you find any backlash or any difficulty in interviewing conservative politicians covering news? Did you have any problems being more objective with liberal stories? And did you find that your colleagues in journalism were skeptical about your ability to go into news and the fact that they even hired you? How did you get hired when people would have said, look, we know you're a liberal. You've already worked for a progressive on a presidential campaign. Clearly, you cannot be objective in the news. How did you overcome that?
Well, another excellent question, and I'm not saying that just to blow smoke that really gets right at the core of things. When I got into the news business, that was one of my big worries. And so I kind of went through a period. My first job was at ABC News, which was perfect because it was really Ted Koppel's Nightline at ABC News that turned me into a complete and total news junkie. And I thought he just had the best job in the world. And so I got into this business, and they quizzed me in the beginning. Do you think you can be objective down the middle? And I said, look, I have my personal views, but I fiercely believe, and I still do, it's almost like a religious belief to me, but it is my job to completely set my views aside, completely, when I'm doing a story. And I remember when I used to work on Capitol Hill in the White House, it was only when I was driving home at night that I would stop and think, where does this fit into my belief system? My job, it's like being a lawyer at a law firm. I represented, as I told you earlier, I represented some clients I couldn't stand. But my job as a lawyer is to, under the, I forget what the name of the thing is, the Code of Official Conduct, whatever it is, the lawyer rules, the name of it escapes me now, it's been almost 30 years, but you are obligated to zealously represent whoever your client is as a lawyer. And I did, even though I couldn't stand some of these investment bankers who I was working with, but I worked my tail off for them. And now my job is to be down the middle, no matter what I think about an issue. My views are absolutely irrelevant, my personal views on the issue. And sometimes I really have to look at it and make sure I'm doing that. But I try to get both sides or all sides. You know, sometimes you only have 2 minutes to express three different points of view, so it can be difficult. But it really is almost like a religious obligation to me. It was not hard for me to convince ABC News and then the other news operations that I have worked for that I really take this seriously. I come down the middle. I don't show my point of view.
Now, Chip, you seem to have expressed a visceral dislike for your work as an attorney supporting the financial services industry. I'm sure that you must have felt a similar many individuals in the world, regardless of their career path, might feel a visceral dislike of a certain type of person, ideology or thought or action that goes against what they believe in. My question to you is, can you talk about a time when you have questioned whether you made the right choice in entering journalism or questioned your ability to continue, when you really had a moment of sincere doubt with this new pathway that you took in your life career?
Not from a philosophical point of view. I mean, I never thought this is not the business for me. Or Well, let me give you two answers to that. The first one is there was a time when I thought I went from ABC and I decided I didn't want to be a producer, that I wanted to try the on-air thing, and I went into local news. And mm-hmm. I spent 6 years in local news, two as a producer and then four as a reporter. And it was a real struggle to make it from local to network. And I was just, as much as I enjoyed it, I was getting a little tired of doing school board meetings and murders and local news. I mean, as important as they are on the local scene, I really wanted to get back to the national issues that I had dealt mm-hmm. with when I worked for Joe Biden on Capitol Hill and in the presidential campaign. So there was a time when I thought, okay, what am I going to do if I can't make it to the network? Unfortunately, NBC started this new thing called MSNBC long before it became ideological. It was just a down-the-middle news organization back then.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my foot in the door at the network level, and I haven't looked back at all. But also, right now, I do feel like a little bit of a fish out of water sometimes because I'm an old-fashioned journalist. I hate Twitter. I think it's a cesspool of snark, nastiness, and misinformation. And in fact, I have never tweeted in my entire career. I do keep an eye on it, but that's very easy to do at CBS News because we have all these younger people who are on Twitter all the time, and if there's something important, they let you know. I mean, in my mind, Twitter is like a giant football-sized cesspool that people are wading through up to their knees and they're reaching down through the muck to look for diamonds, and every once in a while they find a diamond. But I have no interest in dating the person who's looking for those diamonds. We have people who love to do that. So there is important information on Twitter, and obviously you've got to keep track of what Donald Trump is saying on Twitter. But for the people who spend huge amounts of time every day going through Twitter, I think it's a to me, it's a waste of time. So I feel like I'm kind of, and I know it's so important to many journalists today. I don't do Facebook. I don't do social media at all. And I'm an old-fashioned journalist, so just the facts, man. And it's and rather than spend time on Twitter or on Facebook or some social media, I go to Capitol Hill and I sit down and I talk to people or I get them on the phone. I think face-to-face journalism is the way to do it, not to spend all day sitting and looking at a computer.
So on that topic, you mentioned Twitter, which is limited to 140 characters. And at the same time that there's this growing trend towards technology and brevity, there's also been, for a time, a trend away from large network news organizations investing in investigative journalism. And recently, there's been a trend of independent organizations investing in investigative journalism. Pulitzer Prize recently went to an organization called ProPublica, which is filled with individuals who formerly were journalists in esteemed journalistic institutions and who potentially might have had perspectives such as yourselves, might have referred to themselves as old-fashioned journalists who prefer to get the story. Can you talk a little bit about the appeal of such organizations, the influence and impact of those organizations, and how news is evolving in towards both brevity on the one side and now independent organizations that are going towards length and depth?
Yeah, well, I think it's wonderful. ProPublica is a great example of that. It is something I think about for this next stage, possible next stage in my career. Now, I will confess that I have network news is perfect for me, and it may sound a little hypocritical that I say one reason I don't like Twitter is because of the 140-character limit, but here I am doing minute 30 and two-minute pieces on the evening news, and that's pretty brief, too, but it so suits me. I love having a daily story. As I discovered at Vassar College, I'm a procrastinator. I will, if I have a three-day assignment, I will do it all on the last day and do it all later. The news business is fantastic because I have deadlines every day. I can't procrastinate. You absolutely cannot. You got to be working all the time because the stories come at you so quickly. So this
have you ever watched yourself?
My personality. I don't watch myself much. There are some people who watch themselves all the time. You know, every story, either because they just like watching themselves or, as many of them say, well, I watch what I need to improve. I've always avoided it because all I see is what I don't like. But my wife, when I go home, she says, you need to watch this. you know, she records every show, and last night she wanted me to see it because I thought I had had a stumble that I was really mad about, and she said, just watch it, and I watched it, and it wasn't even noticeable. So I don't like to watch myself on TV, but I, you know, under the cracking whip of my wife, I do, because she either wants me to show me that it wasn't as bad as I thought, or you did something that I didn't like, you know, whatever.
You referred to generational trends. When you spoke about Twitter, you said that the younger people in a news organization tend to be on that. You insinuated that social media seems to be something that millennials in particular may be more facile with. So the question, and then, of course, you may also notice that there are such organizations like Netflix that is internet-only based viewing, or Amazon Prime, and those also tend to have higher subscription rates among millennials. The implication is that you're in the TV business, right? Not only are you in news, but you're in the delivery of news through the television. 2 minute sound bites, maybe, but of course there are these generational trends where accessing media is increasingly through the internet for millennials, and many millennials are canceling TV subscriptions, don't own a TV, watch all their movies and TV shows on their computers without commercials. So the question is, you know, what's happening to TV news, especially if it can't reach a growing and now the largest, to some extent, the largest demographic in the nation?
Well, it is concerning, no doubt about it. The one reason that I love TV news programs like the CBS Evening News is that if you sit down and watch it, you get some of everything. So it pushes against what is happening today, which is people are only watching what they want to see and hear. They're, you know, if you have three, in fact, I remember doing a panel on this at Vassar probably 15 years ago, where I said what scared me was the direction things are going, where people are only going to watch a particular political point of view. They're only going to watch things that they love, and the rest of the world is going to be excluded from their little world. And that concerns me. And what I love about a broadcast that covers soup to nuts is that you get a little bit of everything, even if it is only a half an hour a day. And I do think the younger generations are focusing on what they want to hear from a political point of view. You know, they're watching Fox or they're watching MSNBC in the evening, where it's either liberal or conservative, instead of watching all points of view. Or they're watching shows, you know, I remember 15 years ago, I said at Vassar, I said, I'm concerned about people who only want to watch liberal commentators, baseball, and fishing, you know, or whatever it is. And you get into your narrow little world rather than being educated to some degree about everything. And that's what I love about old-fashioned news programs.
So two more questions. Just the first one is a segue off of what you just said, which is you get a little bit of everything in the network news. Can you compare and contrast that to picking up the front page of the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, the New York Times, or the LA Times?
Yeah, well, I think that's also, you know, if you get your news through the internet, you can very easily program it so that you only get articles on certain things. The great thing about a newspaper, and I'm old enough that I still get the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post delivered to my house, and I actually pick up the newspaper and paging through it, it is just like the evening news. You get a little bit of everything. But, of course, as we all know today, you can just selectively choose only the things that you really care about. And I think that's very bad. I think everybody needs to be broadly educated about what's happening in the world of news.
I'm going to actually cheat and insert two more questions at this point. So you would say that the public is being would be responsible in ensuring that there is a strong democracy in this country if they were to access and read through multiple viewpoints in the front of a major newspaper to the same extent as if they were to watch a show from a major network. Would you say that the equal benefits?
Yes, I think they're very similar in that regard.
Okay, and now as we end the approach the end of this podcast, a final question, which is to ask you to reflect upon your years in public service. You have been a political staffer, you have been an corporate attorney, and for a long time now you've been a journalist. I'd like to ask you, what drives you to advance the public interest. Why take a big pay cut from a large corporate firm while having large student debt, I'm presuming, from law school, which is very expensive to attend, to go to a local news station, to go to an ABC and start with an entry level when you're mid-career, you know, 33 years old, maybe you want to get married and have kids, or, you know, a lot of listeners are actually facing these challenges. So the question I'd like to pose to you, Chip, is why? Why advance the public interest? What is your legacy? What do you hope to give to the world? Why is it so important to do public service?
I wish I could tell you exactly why. I don't know if it's genetic or my parents' influence or just the way I turned. But, when I was a teenager, I just decided I wanted to do something meaningful, meaning I wanted to help people. I wanted to educate people. I thought about being a teacher. I thought about a lot of different fields, but they all involved helping people who needed help or educating people who needed to be educated or doing something that I feel good about. And at the same time, it also had to be fun, had to be interesting. I think that if I had stayed at the law firm by this point, I would have had enough money to retire very comfortably 10 years ago. I don't have enough money now to retire. I make a good salary, but I would not have the money to, you know, to travel and enjoy myself with my wife, and not worry about money. But I don't care because I love what I do, and I don't want to retire. I don't know what my next stage is going to be, but it's going to be something where I'm helping. And my wife and I both were animal nuts. We don't have kids, but we have 3 horses, 3 dogs, and a cat. And we sometimes dream about having getting a farm and rescuing animals. And being, we have 2 pit bulls. It's no longer helping people, it's helping animals. But we both have a powerful need to feel like we're helping people or animals in need. And it's just always been part of my makeup. And if I had gone that other route, the law firm, I'd be rich and miserable.
So that has been Chip Reed, CBS News national correspondent, former chief White House correspondent, who speaks about his motivation for public service as one that has always been deep within him. But he touches upon a familiar theme here at Public Interest Podcast, which is that you can help the world and at the same time really enjoy yourself. Selfless isn't to be miserable. To be selfless and to help the world is often, in a way, to be selfish. Chip is someone who finds great satisfaction and enjoyment out of the most interesting, dynamic, and fun workplace environment that can be imagined for him. Chip is somebody who helps people who need help. He's always been interested in educating people. He has worked in South Africa on apartheid. He has advanced human rights. He's worked for causes he's believed in with the Joe Biden presidential campaign in 1987. But ultimately, he sees himself as somebody who is an advocate for the public interest, who is able to get his story out, and a facilitator for the improvement of democracy and enhancement of democratic processes in this republic. So, Chip, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure, and I could say all that about you, too.
And this has been episode 101 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you next time.